From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
Filling in for Gove, who is out this month on vacation, enjoying whatever things he's doing there.
Yeah. Not being at Microsoft.
Yeah, not being on email. All right, first question here from Blaine. He says, I deal a lot with files and moving them around all the time. When I go to delete, copy, or move a file, Windows will scan the folder and subfolder before it starts a real process of deleting, copying, or moving. I know that it's doing this so that it can tell me how long it's going to take and the progress moves at the correct speed, which I'm not so sure that's what it's doing, but okay. The annoying part is it takes a while for it to start. Is there a magic keyboard combination like Shift-Delete or a registry key that will turn this off so Windows just starts the action without the scan? So I've seen this. I mean, I do an annual and a semi-annual backup, and if I'm moving terabytes of data, it takes a while before the actual copy starts, and you hear it kind of, you know, ticking through a bunch of stuff. Yeah. So what's going on there?
So I didn't know myself what actually was happening under the covers and why it was doing this, so I went and asked the shell team about it at length. And what it's doing is building up a playlist, what it's about to go do.
Yeah.
And so what they've done is optimized Explorer so that preemptively, they know that if I do this analysis first and then do the copy, it will actually overall take less I.O. because you don't go, is there a file there? Copy it. Is there a file there? Copy it. You just do it once. Here's all the files. Yeah. And then start the copies. And performance-wise, I'm told that Explorer actually will run faster than Xcopy, which takes the other approach in certain scenarios. The problem is it's the certain scenarios
get you.
So Explorer is designed or optimized for a couple levels deep, mainly files and folders with a very few folder tree, few number of folders in the tree. In this case, the opposite case, and something I personally also get, is that when you have a deep tree, roughly what it's doing at the start is doing a search in each folder, gathering up the entire file list, and then doing the copies.
So it's getting a complete folder structure.
Yeah. The good news is it's actually a visual thing rather than a reality thing. It's going to do the same work.
Yeah.
And so it actually is going to take 8 minutes no matter what.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because it takes 4 minutes to do the enumeration and you know, 8 minutes to do the copy.
Yeah.
It still has to do the enumeration. It just happens to be splicing it in the other way, and you just don't really perceive that there's a delay.
So, yeah.
Yes, it's annoying. No, it doesn't matter.
You can't get rid of it.
You can't get rid of it.
Either way, it's going to do it no matter what you do.
Yeah, and every version of Windows is the same that way.
Okay. All right, next question from Golnaz, who's sitting at the board right now. She says, I get this a lot on several laptops, whatever it says in the pic. What does this mean? And what it says is one of your disks needs to be checked for consistency. You may cancel the disk check, but it's strongly recommended that you continue. And you can see Golnaz right there.
You're in full detail. There we go.
The background there. So there you go. Yeah, I've seen this before. Dirty bit set and needs to run check disk.
Yeah, there's two parts. This is check disk, and this is the check disk you see at boot. And the reason why you see it at boot rather than you run it at a command prompt is that the files are in use, and so it can't modify the files which are obviously in use. So you could do like a D drive or some removable drive. So this comes up when the OS boots because nothing's in use yet and runs.
And you can skip past this,
yes.
But
it doesn't clear the status. And there's two parts to this. There's NTFS detects that it is dirty, as in it is not in a transactional, succinct space. And when it detects that, it automatically kicks it in on the Windows boot.
Yeah.
The other option is you say, I just want to forcibly do it. And if you do a... I'll do it to my box. A check disk C. It will say the file system's in use, and do you want to? Oh, what are you doing to me? Don't do it now. Oh, I know why, because I didn't do fix. So it's just doing a scan. It will say, do you want to do it when it restarts?
Yeah.
That has the same effect as doing it as it went down dirty. It sets the bit saying, check disk needs to run on next boot.
Yeah.
Until you finish check disk. So if you skip it and then go into Windows, the next time you come around, it's still set, it still knows it needs to be scanned, and it's still going to do it again. If you've done it once, that should be the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right? There is, once you've set it here, you can't unset it. There is a... where is it? This one, I think. There's a command called
a command called add.
Check NTFS/X, and you can say that will cancel the pending bit status.
Yeah.
So if it's been done automatically, you don't want to be stripping that bit because it needs to be scanned.
Yeah.
The rough deal is that if you drop the power on a SATA drive, don't quote me on the numbers, but I think it's like 1 in 20 chance you'll get into this dirty state because nothing's been flushed on a SATA drive.
Yeah.
On SAS drives like the enterprise drives, the numbers are way higher because they've got power-backed memory cache on them, and so they'll always flush out and stuff like that.
So on a laptop like Olnaz's, what are the typical things that would cause that? Just the battery?
If the battery kicks out. So what you could do is when the system gets low on battery, it starts to shut down, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it has to have enough battery to actually do that.
Yeah.
And so there's a... where's it? Hibernate. Is it under battery? All right, so on the low battery action, what do you do? And so what you want to do is say, change the timeout. So say it's at 7% battery, and you know that there's not enough battery to actually flush out your disk and shut down in at 7%, bump it up to 10% or 15%, and just take the hit a little bit earlier and make it so that you can get down while still having battery left.
Yeah, awesome.
And you've got to remember that, I mean, if it's a physical drive, it takes a lot of power to spin that disk, particularly when you're doing writes and stuff.
Okay, yeah, cool. All right, next question. I've received an email from the Windows Live team asking for my personal information and password. Did anyone else receive the same, or am I being hacked? You're not being hacked yet.
Not yet.
That's good news. The bad news is don't respond to those, please, ever. There's never, ever any chance that someone from Microsoft's going to ask for personal information.
No. So the act of doing that is called phishing, and it's not F-I-H, F-I-S-H is P-H-I-S-H.
Yeah.
Microsoft actually has on their Safety and Security Center a what is phishing explanation.
Yeah.
And it comes in the form of emails, websites, and phone calls. So, you know, you have people like ring up and say, I'm from Microsoft support. You've won a free checkup.
Yeah.
Do you want us to connect to your box and fix it for you? That doesn't happen. And so this page explains what these concepts are. And then Microsoft actually has a page also on what Microsoft will and won't do. And quite frankly, we won't do anything. We won't contact you for any type of private information.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone calls up and says they're Microsoft or is a website that doesn't have Microsoft.com on it, be very wary. At the same time, be very wary of... what's called the phishing of links. So it may look like Microsoft.com, but it may have a huge URL on the end of it, which could be an attempt to obfuscate what the real purpose is.
Yeah, and the thing is, unless you've called Microsoft for support, they're never going to call you. We never call anyone for any reason, unless it's a return of support call.
And in fact, if you have doubts, even if I'm in Microsoft support, if you have doubts, drop the phone, ring the phone number, and ask to be connected back to the person you're talking to.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, next question. I recently did a complete reinstall Windows 7 after getting some bug checks over the past month or two. Since yesterday's reinstall, I've been running Windows Updater to get all the security updates installed before I install anything else on the computer. There's still one, well, at the moment it's one, update, KB2567680, that refuses to download and install. It says error code found 800B0100. I've tried the following online help to no avail, and has a window. What is a system update readiness tool link for Windows 7 64-bit. After that didn't resolve the issue, I went to support and ran fix it and still gained the error.
So this person did all the right things. They did a search for the error code that came up, and it's this page. And this actually is a pretty bad error code because it says that Windows Update itself is not installed correctly. So it's not the hotfix they're trying to install, or the update they're trying to install. It's in Windows Update itself that is having issues. And they followed the guidance on here, which is run the system update readiness tool. They did that. It didn't solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're at the point where you go, you know, it says, if this doesn't work, go to answers.microsoft.com,
yeah,
which is where we got this from. The next step is, unfortunately, much more forensic, much more troubleshooting.
Yeah.
And we have to work out what's going on, what DLL is bad, what something is just not behaving correctly. So there's two parts to this. There's system logging, and then there is just straight raw analysis. From a system logging point of view, if the failure is with an MSI or MSP, anything that's Windows installer based, there, which is all what Windows Update comes down as, there is significant logging that you can turn on, and it's called voice warm-up. If you can just remember the phrase voice warm-up, what there is there's a registry key, and there's, you can fix it, but do it just by click the button, it will set it for you. But there's a registry key for Windows installer that turns on logging, and it just so happens that the phrase voice warm-up represents every single thing. So like V is verbose, O is out of disk. And so you just turn logging on for every single one of these letters, and you'll get a log file. And the log file will say, I am starting to copy file X, I failed because of this exact error code, bang, 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 bang.
Mm-hmm.
So that will give you an MSI-based issue, which is what Windows Update issue is. If it's Windows Update purely, and it's not even getting to the Windows installer part of Windows Update, so Windows Update is like the download service,
yeah,
and then it has to be handed off to Windows installer to do the install. What you need to do is do some tracing. And we've shown this before. There's a program called Procmon from SysInternal, so sysinternals.com, Procmon. And then what we're going to do is just trace all activity in the box. And so you'll start this, it starts tracing automatically, try redoing it again, and then when you're finished, stop the trace, which is this little magnifying glass. And then in the case of Windows Update, you're going to look for strings that have the word like update in them.
Yeah.
And so what I personally would do is make a filter, a highlight filter, like a good highlight, and then over here, you can see the result is success.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to see anything that's not success. And so it's going to give me the bad stuff. So I can scroll through here and go, oh, that was bad, that was bad. Now, there's a couple of things that we can throw away. And this is a good one. No more entries. So what this is doing is it's iterating through hollow registry keys, and then it gets to the end and it says there's no more.
Yeah.
So that's one which you don't care about. So each column, if you right click on here, you'll get the path.
Yeah.
If you click over here, you'll get the, so we want to get rid of this, a result of no more entry, so we'll exclude that.
Very cool.
And slowly you'll filter it down. So what you'll do is you'll do a find, look for the word update. I'm not running a Windows Update now, so you won't find the word update or something that's something associated with what you're doing.
Yeah.
Find the some activity in that space, and then you'll end up with a row, and let's say that it's, I would say it's Search Indexer for this example, then I would only include that program, and you'll just refine it down. And then there's some noise in here, like this is just asking about the what the file system's doing, and so that's not important to me.
Yeah.
And you just keep on filtering and filtering down, and what you'll end up with is a whole lot of successes intermingled with some errors. And the error will be the exact issue. And you'll get the error code, you'll get exactly what DLL is bad, and then you can troubleshoot further. Once you have that file and you've kind of shrunk it down to, because it could be gigabytes, shrunk it down to this semi-viewable thing, go file save as, PML file, zip it up, it's zipped up great, send it to defrag and we can go further. It's one of those cases where I can't, without having raw
being
data
on the machine, seeing it,
With a lot of the tools that are available these days, you don't actually have to be at the machine as much, which is kind of good because, 10 years ago you did.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the SysInternals tools have given us the ability to capture the state and bring it in-house.
So because this is a recently flattened machine, would repaving it again fix it, or do you think they'd end up in just, a little bit further down the road, they end up with the same problem?
I don't know, actually. I mean,
because I think I'd probably try to just, format again, give it, get rid of the hard drive, nuke the hard drive, and just do it again.
It could have been a bad download. It could have been a corrupted download that it's struggling with. If it truly is that fresh, yeah. then yeah, it would
it's
be
worth
one try.
Yeah.
But if it happens again, in any type of way like that, then you need to go down the forensic route.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Next question. When I open a Windows Media Player manually or open a video defaulted to open with the program, it takes too long for the media to play. When I open the program manually and open a video file defaulted, well, I've just read that part. It's just sticks for about 15 seconds before playing correctly. My computer is new with Windows 7's very high-end, 6 gig of DDR3, etc., and other programs open normally except for Media Player.
Yep. So this is going to be a Procmon heavy day because this, once again, is how to solve this problem.
Yeah.
What we're missing here, remember to press reset, by the way, otherwise you'll get stuck in your last session. So what you need to know is where the delay came from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I'm going to try to reproduce it here. I'm probably going to have to use, you know, sub-second numbers versus big numbers. But so what we're going to do is start tracing. I can press Control X to clear it out. I'm going to launch the media player and hope that there's nothing in here incriminating. Actually, here you go. So that's slow, right? That's great.
Yeah, it's taking a little while.
So, all right. So that was a good example. That was great. Stop capturing. So what we know is that this is media player.
Mm-hmm.
So there's my. So there you can see Explorer starting Media Player.
Okay.
So we actually made sure that the file existed, made sure that it actually had the right version and information in it, and then at some point it would have created the process. So we know it's not Explorer, so we can go exclude and jump down. We know it's not Mesh. We know it's not Sierra RSS. Where is it? There we go. Media Player. You're right. So we now got Media Player, and we include it, because we know Media Player is what it's all about.
Yeah.
All right, so there is a column that we're not seeing in here, select columns, and it's called duration. Where is it?
Just to your right, in the middle.
Yeah, I'm going blind. Yeah, it's too early. So here is, this is in fractions of a second, so that zero is the 1 second point.
Okay.
So what we want to do is find a duration that's a bit long. So if we reset the filter and say where the duration is more than, we'll try 1 second. And then, actually I'll do a filter instead. So I did a highlight then. I'll filter the whole data down. So if I double click on it, it goes up the top. Let's try 0.1 of a second. And so there you have it. There's all the calls that took too long. Now, This is where kind of there's limitations of how far you can go.
Yeah.
If it's happy, if it goes, all right, send a network operation and then wait for the response, well, the wait itself isn't the duration. It's the time to, say, send the thing and the time to receive it. So it's kind of hard to work out what it is. So from a duration point of view, we would look for big spikes. And then if you see like a 10-second one in here, and you'll see this when you connect to a network drive.
Yeah.
You'll just see a big number. In my case, I don't have something, so it must be much more granular and fiddly. What we can do is we'll disable that. And so what we want to do now is just scan down here, and what we're going to look for is two operations that were apart. Now, unfortunately, this is a lot of data, and we need to just scroll through this and look for the spikes in the time, and then at some point you'll see something that jumps forward.
Yeah, went from the 60s to the 70s.
Yeah, so it's still not too bad. We're all in the... down in the 10 millisecond range type jumps.
Yeah.
At some point, and we're only a third of the way into the trace at the moment, you'll find that delay. You'll see a gap, and you'll start to realize, well, this is the issue. So, as simple as that. It's a laborious task. Lots of people have asked, you know, how do you do process monitor analysis quickly? And the answer is you don't. it's experience. It's just trial and error.
Yeah.
I mean, given me a little while, I would just slowly go through this. I could kind of filter this down and say, I don't really care about anything to do with the registry and just go down to just down the files. There's things like close file. Mm-hmm. You create a file, then you close it. Well, closing a file is not going to be slow, so let's exclude those. I don't care about the information of a file, which is just looking up its size and stuff like that, so yeah. Get rid of that. Reading from a file matters. It's interesting that it picks up a lot of Internet Explorer stuff. I would have never thought that it would have done that. And so in here somewhere there's a delay, or it could just be the raw amount of what it had to read.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to know that, you can bring up the file summary and see how much I/O has been going on for each file. So it's not a definitive answer, but it's
so
an
it's
approach.
A way to troubleshoot it, though, and you can find out at least what it is that's causing the biggest part of the delay.
Yeah, Mark Krasinovich at TechEd particularly has a speech, and also the PDC or Build has a talk called The Case of the Unexplained, and all he does is go through these type of defrag cases at this type of level.
Yeah,
and he uses Procmon a lot in those talks. And so if you go to systemtalents.com and then there's a click on the left, there's a Mark's videos, and then you can just watch those on demand. They're also available on Channel 9, of course.
Awesome.
Which is probably the better way. Actually, that's the easier way to get to them, actually.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Stay on Channel 9. All right.
Well, you've sucked up all the videos in the world, which is fantastic.
Well, you know, we're working on it. It's not all of them. We still have Netflix. all right, next question. If I use Windows 8 Consumer Preview, will I have the option where it goes to install, or will it automatically overwrite my current operating system? I'm looking to install it to my computer. Thanks for your help, guys. So the question, will it overwrite your current Windows 7 setup? And that is not the way that I would install it.
No.
I would do a clean install of Windows 8 if you want to play around with that. Or...
Actually, there's two options. So you could make another partition.
Yeah.
Right, and so install it onto D drive.
Yeah.
I would definitely not replace... I would not upgrade 7 to 8 because if there's something wrong and you need to actually have a working machine...
It's a preview.
The other option, which is semi-new, is that you can boot from VHD. So mm-hmm. VHD, if you know what an ISO file is for a CD-ROM, a VHD is the equivalent of that for a hard disk.
Yeah.
And so it's the same hard disk format that is used for Hyper-V, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do is just make this single file on the hard drive. And that file actually looks like an entire disk to the operating system. And so that file might be in, you know, C:\Win8Preview. You know, cdrive.vhd.
Yeah.
And then what you can do is boot from that VHD disk and treat it like an entire hard drive, and then it's a fresh disk, and you can have no real hindrance between the two. I believe you actually had I think it was the pick of the week.
Yeah, pick of the week, Hanselman.
Scott
the
Hanselman.
The Brad Pitt of Microsoft geeks.
Yeah. He's a bit, isn't he? and so this article on Scott's blog explains how to exactly do that. And as you'll see, you'll get... So what will happen is the boot system will upgrade to Windows 8.
Yeah.
So the boot part of your PC will be Windows 8, hence why you get this new Metro-ish UI. And you can choose between the two OSs and toggle between the two. The good thing about it is that when you boot it into one, you actually can see the files of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Windows 7, you can actually mount a VHD disk and view it. And in Windows 8, you're obviously looking at a real hard drive. So your Word docs and stuff can stay where they are and be fully accessible when you're running in Windows 8.
Yeah, and the nice thing, too, is if this is the way that you use Windows 8, and then when you're done and you want to just blast it away, it's pretty easy to do.
Well, the other great thing about it, and I didn't really think about this till a while ago, is that once you get it installed and you like it, copy, paste the VHD, and you're done, right?
Yeah.
And that's awesome. And you've got that beautiful restore point, and then if you want to go back, just copy it back.
We're right now we've got 7 machines in the studio that are all the same, so that's one of the things we're looking at is we're going to do a VHD that's you know, the same setup for all of them, just make it easy for us.
I think it's just the way to go. I mean, it's so much simpler.
Yeah.
Just backing up wise and everything
else. Yeah, VHDs can really save a lot of time.
Mm.
Awesome. All right, next question. I need a program that will monitor and log internet usage for a PC, but I need that usage to be logged and broken down, detailing which applications consume the data. I've noted that there are several that give real-time feed of each application's data usage, NetLimiter, Windows 7 Resource Monitor, but I can't find one that will log such data. Anyone know of one? Need to track it down.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a similar question where this person was saying that as soon as they connected to their network, I think it was via Wi-Fi or something, it was just saturated and the entire network was flooded. So the approach I said then was much more designed to be immediate. So this is more of a long-term approach. In the box, there is a couple of tools. And Task Manager here, as we said a couple weeks ago, we can add these two columns, byte sent per interval and byte received per interval. And that will just tell us the traffic, what's going on. So per NIC, you can kind of work out what's going on. The limitation is there is, you know, you don't know who it is. Now, I jumped to the conclusion last week, but I'm going to go through a couple more steps this week. There is the resource monitor. So what the resource monitor does is give you the same information, and of course I've got no traffic. You can do it. Anyway, the resource monitor shows you per process the traffic that's coming in and out, and the granularity is at the website. So here's the multiple websites that like Internet Explorer is touching. And you can see the data in and out, but you're not getting an aggregate count. You're just purely getting the point in time per second count, much like Task Manager has shown you. So if you don't have if this person's machine is not flooded, as in it's just not banging away at the internet, and it's just somewhere it went, you need to kind of work out where it went. So in the box, there's not much we can give you. Once again, this is the week of Procmon. Procmon can do this to a certain extent. What you want to do is turn off registry, file, and image information. That's like program starting, stopping, and just capture network traffic. So there's a couple of things about running process monitor for a long time that you have to be aware of. Currently, you'll see down here, it says backed by virtual memory.
Yeah.
So the log is going to RAM. At some point, you're going to run out of RAM, right? So there's a couple of things. I have this turned on by default. I actually don't, because I press reset. Drop filtered events. So at the moment, there's 160 networked packets, but there's 230,000 other events. So that's the files and the registry stuff. If we go to drop filtered events, it will throw those away. If I press Control X and start again, we're not consuming memory for no good reason. All right? And so this is waiting for network activity. And my box is fantastic. It's not doing anything, which is good, right?
Yeah.
So this is currently in RAM. So what you can do is you can say, give it a backing file. And instead of using the page file, which is where memory goes to, you can choose a file. And so if you have a nice big hard drive, you know, we've got 100 gig free or something, well, not that big, but a big hard drive, back it out to a file. And so you're like, you know, C temp, blah, blah, blah. And then you end up with a capture that's going to a file. So how's this any different to really what you had before? Well, what we want is this little magic gem here, network summary. And so this is the same thing that resource monitor gave you, but instead of being point in time, this is forever. And so we can say that which website used the most traffic. And so you can see per website where it went. And then if you double click on it, it will set a filter and show you all the individual events that build up to it. So in this case, that website who was the highest in my usage list was SFC host. And then you can go on and say, well, there's the program who's using the most amount of network bandwidth. Now, there's limits of how long you can run this trace for. You don't want the trace trial to get too big.
Yeah.
But that's definitely a very easy approach. If you know that there's things like, the printer in your home and maybe your home server in your home, you can exclude those from the list, like from your filtering in the first place. So kind of keep it to the internet-based ones, and then the local traffic that's banging away in your own network won't consume space.
Great. Next question. I'm looking for a very small profile computer that can run Windows 7 and drive 3 to 4 monitors. I'm constrained for space on a work project. Are you aware of a very small hardware system on the market that runs Windows 7 and can drive that many monitors? It mentions an HP T5740E Thin client, which are the right dimensions, something close to that space. So this was also something that we were looking at in the studio. We're looking to replace this table. Believe it or not, someday, yeah. And one of the things, well, maybe we'll retire it to the archive. One of the things that we're looking at is having some screens in there and how we'll drive those screens. And if you have, you know, 3-4 screens, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. So this was something that we were thinking about anyway. And you know, you can get a big PC and put a couple of video cards in there, and
but it's very space.
Yeah, it's a problem. We want something small, maybe even something that goes in the desk. So one of the things I landed on was we bought this nice USB to DVI adapter, and you can have up to 6 of these on a system. Mm-hmm. So as long as your system has the USB ports for it and it mm-hmm. works over USB 2.0. You can plug these into it and then drive your DVI devices through there. Now, I wouldn't use this for playing Crysis or Just Cause 2 or Flight Sim X or anything like that.
Yeah.
But for our purposes, and it sounds like this case too, it's just some pretty simple displays. And so you could give that a try.
Yeah, I mean, Internet Explorer and all those are still going to run fine.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So, any issues with driving a screen over USB? We were talking about this before, and it's not your favorite way to
There's a couple of issues that come to play. The most obvious one is bandwidth.
Yeah.
So, USB 2 has a finite bandwidth.
Yeah.
It also has a finite amperage as well. So, mm-hmm. does this have a power, actually a plug pack involved?
I don't recall if it does or not. I don't think it does. So it might be powered off the
USB.
Bus. Yeah.
So, USB has a certain amount of amperage that's available, so that's the number one thing. So you just can't put, you know, your nightlight and your fan and everything else on the same one. And I'm guessing this may take a little bit of amperage. So there'll be a limit of how many you can put on from an amperage point of view, and then obviously bandwidth. Well, video is high bandwidth.
Yeah.
So I would guesstimate that you can't get too many of those on a single USB cut.
Yeah, it says it supports up to 2048 by 1152, but I can't imagine, you know, if you had 6 of those, you're going to run out eventually.
Yeah, and so each like port on your laptop doesn't necessarily have a controller behind it. It's like it could be like a hub that you'd have at home where you have like 4. That has to share bandwidth. So you actually can see what you have in a box. I actually didn't pre-prepare this, but we'll try it anyway. So if you go view by connection, so most people don't really know that this exists, but what you can do is, here's ACPI, so this is the start of all Windows, so Advanced Controller Peripheral Interface. This is how Windows talks to hardware at the start. And then this is a compliant system, and then you can see all my cores, and then here's the PCI bus. So like a motherboard, a laptop has that as well, just a bit more shrunk in. And then on that, you can then see, in my case, I have 2 USB controllers, right? So each of those controllers is bound by the USB speed. So when you plug in, so the controller talks to a hub, much like you would in a physical hub, but it's just modeled logically. And then a generic one, and then you can see that my mouse is plugged into one of those. So there's things inside this machine that already are using up slots, like the high-def camera on my monitor, right? And the fingerprint reader.
Yeah.
So there's already bandwidth being used up, right, or assuming they're turned on. So when you plug it in, you need to make sure that when you're plugging it in, you're spreading them around.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, on a desktop system, it tends to be a bit easier than a laptop. Laptop tends to be a bit crunched.
Yeah.
But make sure that you're not exceeding that. Each device will tell you, if you click on it, I think it's under details, it will tell you the wattage, power data. It will tell you, what's it under? There's a field here in there that tells you the exact amperage. And so you actually find out how much power every device is using.
Yeah. So you could add that up, and there's probably a number you don't want to go over.
I will tell you what the limit is. I think it's on the... here we are. So this guy.
Total available.
total valve was 500, and we're using 100 amps for that guy, for example.
And so if you have an external hub that's powered, that wouldn't take off of this,
no.
Right?
So it's just purely a bandwidth issue then.
So it might be that you just want to use an external hub if you're approaching the power limit, but then you're still going to have the constraints of your bandwidth. So if you can split it up, even better.
So maybe two per thing and hope that the USB ports on your machine aren't funneling through one hub inside it anyway. Because it is a tree of speed. You need to have it split across literally two controllers.
And it might be that, like on your laptop, you might have all your USB devices hooked onto one of the hubs and the other ones for all the internal devices. But, I mean, there's just no way
to know. Yeah, on laptops particularly, they do tend to put the external ones on one hub and then all the devices that are built into the machine on another hub. So your options are very limited.
Okay.
You know?
Well, there's...
But saying that, though, docking stations usually fix that issue. They give you another PCI deck. And so if you're into that many monitors...
Yeah.
Well, a docking station will give you at least one more.
Yeah.
And then the docking station tends to have a good high-speed interface that gives you a new set of USB ports.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Next question. I'm looking for something like SMEM, but for Windows 7 instead of Linux.
All right. So
let's talk about SMEM a little bit. And what
I didn't know what it was until I read about it.
Yeah.
Roughly what it's saying is, how is my memory being used?
Yeah.
Once, much like bug checks, like we talked about last week, this is a half-hour, one-hour conversation.
Yeah.
If you want to know what memory is, go to Channel 9 and look up for Mysteries of Memory Management Revealed by Mark Rusinovich. It's a two-part, one-and-a-half-hour talk each, a three-hour talk, and it explains what memory is. The first talk is about what's called virtual memory, which is what applications have to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half of the talk is about physical memory, which is about what the OS has to worry about. So this program is designed to tell you how memory is carved up.
Yeah.
So there's two tools, once again, sysinternals. Everything in the world is sysinternals. If people don't know, if you just type in the website name, press Control Enter, it automatically puts .com on for you.
Nice.
So you don't have to.
Yeah.
So there's two tools, and they are called VMMAP, which maps out virtual memory,
mm-hmm.
and RAMMAP, under R, RAMMAP. So let's do a quick demonstration of what those two look like. All right. So we'll start with VMMAP. And we'll just choose something. I don't know, what should we choose? I don't know. A media player. There we go. So what this is showing is how memory is carved up in the process. So a process is responsible for... Well, the process memory space has to contain everything that program needs. So it has to have the executables in memory. It has to have... memory assigned for the threads that are running. It has to have memory assigned for the environment variables and the current directory and blah, 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 blah. And that's what all this graphing is trying to tell us. So what it does is it splits up on the left here. Images is executable, so we can filter down to DLLs and exes. Map files are executables that you want to see into but not execute from. And the classic example is what's called NLS files, which is how you read strings. So Microsoft, the executables themselves don't ever have a string resource in it. They call out to an NLS file to get the language-specific rendering of OK, cancel, stuff like that. And so that way, if there's a bug in the code, they only have to release the code once instead of recompile it for every single language. They only have to compile it once. And that was new in Windows Vista. It was one of the major, major changes in Vista that was made the hot fix story much better. Shareable memory is memory that is shared across processes. So I can actually allocate some memory in my process, and you can allocate some memory in your process, and we actually can share it. So if I write into there, your process sees it, and so be it. Heap is, if you're a C coder, it's new, right? New and free, new and delete. It's where memory goes. It's just the normal memory that you allocate. If this was a .NET program, it goes into the managed heap. So this is the things that the garbage collector worries about controlling. And you'll see GC0, GC1, GC2 are the three names, and the large object heap. Stacks, this is the per thread information. Private data is memory that wasn't allocated via a runtime type DLL, so not by a heap operation, not by a new or delete in Visual C. It's where I've gone, just allocate raw memory, and the function is called virtual alloc. Page table is how the memory is mapped between virtual memory and physical memory, the overhead, and then due to fragmentation issues and stuff like that, this is the unusable space. And then in this case, there is 1.8 gig free. So this is a 32-bit process, and so if you add up that and everything above it, you will hit the magic number 2 gig, which is the maximum number a 32-bit process can have. So if you're seeing a program that says out of memory, then you, if you open up this space, you can see where all the memory went, as in for what purpose, and then you'll say, well, it's out of memory. Now, you don't actually have to be out of memory and have this at zero. It could be at, say, a megabyte, right? Yeah. But the fragmentation on the might be so bad that you can't even allocate 4K, or a bad example, but 40K, because the fragmentation, the biggest, smallest block is 16. And so you can slice and dice a piece in any application with this. And so in this case, purple, these ones up to about here. So this guy is about 75% overhead of just the process itself and the rest of its data. Cool. So that's a VM map. So that tells us how an application is carved up, right? All this information in the middle is about working set. So that's the amount of memory that this process has that actually currently is in physical memory, all right? So even though there's 87 megabytes of image, only 21 megabytes of the exes are in memory at the moment. Well, why is that? Well, I've never opened up the about dialog. Well, it won't load the about dialog into memory if you haven't executed it. So everything's on demand. And so you want to keep your working set kind of low, but not so low that it's causes paging, so there's a balance. So so that's how to do it as an application. There's another tool called RAMMap, and this one you have to run as a min because it's diving deep into the bowels of Windows. Exactly the same idea, but it is mapping physical memory and where physical memory is used. So at the moment, there is... You kind of want to read this one the other way. You want to read it across. You want to read the total. So currently, on my box, there's 2.7 gig that is actively being used, as in it's in working set. There is 1.4 gig in standby, and I'll come back to that in a sec. Modified means that there is data that has been written to and needs to be paged out to the page file, all right, for integrity. 52K modified, but we're not going to write to the disk, 8K in this transition state, and zeroed. So at the moment, there is nearly 4 gig of memory free in my box. If I open up a file, right, and read it, like a media player file or something like that, it will get loaded, it'll get put into memory, and then the usage of it will come out of the active part. And then once it's finished being used, you know, closed media player, we don't just say, well, that file wasn't useful. We've got no reason to use the RAM. In fact, my box still has 4 gig that's never been touched.
Yeah.
Right? So it just keeps it in memory. So the file is in memory right now. And so if you reopen media player, it will load that 1.4 gig instantaneously out of memory. It won't go to the disk to go get it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the standby... I can't say it's the file cache, but a large proportion of it is the file cache, okay? So if you look at your box and you see that all the memory is used, that is fantastic because it means that you're getting a really optimal performance. And this is what Prefetch does at boot. Prefetch goes and loads all the subparts of the program that they know that heuristically or tracking-wise that you've touched on each boot, and it goes and loads all those and shoves it in main memory and just leaves it pre-populates the file case. So if you boot your machine, I think it's 5 times, after 5 times and use it, obviously, its training is now accurate and you should get like 95% hit rate when you boot, which means that you boot faster because it's preloaded all the data and everything's good.
Nice.
If you actually want to see what's in there, so I can look at the whoever's the biggest. So I haven't got any big files open yet, but any file I've ever opened will still be there. So there's software redistribution is Windows Update type stuff. Mm-hmm. There's Flash stuff here. There's tons of stuff. None of these programs have to be still running, right? And so you can have a good idea of where your memory went. So VMAP, RAMMAP, I mean, that was the 5-minute, 10-minute version,
yeah.
Right? Definitely watch Mysteries of Memory Management Revealed by Rusinovich on Channel 9. Fantastic. And I actually brought in the book again. There is two huge sections in this book based on that.
Yeah.
And they go through every single field and explain what every single field represents and where it comes from and what you should or shouldn't be worried about.
Awesome. Cool.
So that's my quick memory summary.
All right. Memory in a nutshell. Next question. Every time I boot my Windows, it starts Bluetooth by default. I don't use it very frequently. Is there an option by which Bluetooth does not come up by default on startup?
Yeah, so it's kind of similar to Wi-Fi. If you open up Device Manager, so I don't actually have Bluetooth on my laptop,
yeah.
So I can't show it, obviously, in here. But, for example, let's say it's my Wi-Fi. It's only there because you've told Windows I want to start it. Mm-hmm. So if you right-click on it in here and go Disable, it will stay disabled forevermore.
Yeah.
And so when you have those tray icons, and like particularly with Wi-Fi, you can press Function and then the Wi-Fi button, mm-hmm. that's all it's doing. It's just enabling and disabling the device driver that represents that hardware.
Yeah.
So if you change this to disable on the Bluetooth one, then Bluetooth will not start at Windows Start. It will honor what you ask for it to do, and then you're done. And then there's programs...
It'll save you a little bit of battery, too.
Yeah, toggling it back, it's as hard as Device Manager, but there's also tends to be tray icons
that
do it as well.
Awesome. Cool. Next question. In Windows 7 Explorer, I have set up a new library called Tools. How can I tell Windows 7 that in that folder only executable files should be indexed? Currently, when I type the name of one of the tools in the Start menu, it lists all the DLLs, config files, etc.
So I'll give you an example of this, and I don't think a problem here. So if I look at Advanced System Settings, Environment Variables, on here, where's my path? I have on here somewhere, if I can find it, sysinternals, mm-hmm. because I use it so much that I put it on the path. Oh, believe me, it's there somewhere. So you would say, well, if what this person's worrying about, sysinternals, latest. So for example, I know down the bottom here, if I sort it correctly, there is some sys files.
Yeah.
So we don't want those indexed.
We
don't want those things to turn up in the start bar. So if I press start and press control and 2, you'll see that the exe turned up.
Yeah.
But none of the sys files did.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there actually isn't a problem here. It will filter out the non-executables in start. So if you think there is an issue, then contact us again and we will look into it.
Cool. All right, pick of the week time. It is pick of the week time. And my pick of the week this week is 10 things you didn't know your Lumia could do. And so this is an article over on the Nokia site, conversations.nokia. And you can also see it on the Windows Phone blog. And it tells you 10 different things that you might not even know about the very hot-selling Lumia phone. There's some things in there like Local Scout, how to find Marketplace apps without having to go to Marketplace. There's some stuff about how to scan a QR code without a special app, how to take a photo without unlocking your phone, and some other stuff. So
most of the stuff, I've got a 710.
Yeah.
I've had it for a couple of months. Most of these things apply as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic phone. I mean,
yeah.
I've never really been a smartphone person. I have fallen in love with this phone. And the 900, we have a couple of people in my office have them already.
Yeah.
And everybody's just drooling over them. Yeah. So I can see why people are why there's so much buzz, because it's justified. It is a fantastic phone.
Yeah, so if you've got one, you can go there and check out some of their things. You might want to check it out anyway. There's some stuff that you can just do anyway.
Obviously, the AT&T has them in America at the moment. You can get them at the Microsoft store as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic phone. And then the 710, which I've got, T-Mobile has at the moment.
And then your pick of the week.
Pick of the week.
I was surprised when I saw this.
Well, so I'm kind of people guessing from the accent. I'm Australian.
Yeah.
So from Australia, we're quite remote.
Mm-hmm.
And when I joined Microsoft, it was a big leap of faith because, you know, we don't get the recruiters coming around at college, and you don't really see what campus life is like or even hear about it. You don't meet people from Microsoft. I think I'd met maybe 3 people from Microsoft in my life before joining Microsoft. And this series, which you did.
Yeah, me, Nick, Tina, shot a bunch of these.
It's called Campus Tours. It just goes around parts of campus and shows what campus life is like. And particularly the one that we should all care about here is this one right here, is actually going around this studio right here with you as the host. I wish I'd actually had this before I joined Microsoft. Not that I don't want to join Microsoft, but it would have been a bit more comforting to know what I was getting myself into.
Yeah.
Like, I have no idea how, like, Google and Facebook and all them operate. They're not as publicly
transparent.
Yeah. And this is a really good, really good summary of campus life, from the buses. It's all the things that aren't your job that actually matter in the end.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the buses, the dining, all the other things that Microsoft give you.
One of the things that really, I mean, it kind of started back when we were doing Channel 10 is, you know, we have to go out and talk to people in their offices. We go to a lot of different buildings. You know, there's over 100 buildings right here just on the main campus.
And that's what people don't realize that. So there's main campus Redmond, but there's 5 other campuses within a 10-minute drive of campus.
And they're big campuses too.
Yeah, I mean, mine has 3 massive buildings in
it
and thousands of people.
Yeah, so, I mean, we go around to all these different buildings, and we see some cool stuff. Like, you go to the Xbox building, there's huge Halo guys standing in the entry. And, you know, sometimes you see, like, a cool, you know, I forget what the thing is. It's like shuffleboard game and stuff like that. And there's just all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, Microsoft Surfaces are in the lobbies,
Yeah, and, you know, you're going past a room, you see the anechoic chamber or something. You know, you're like, wow, I can't believe that's there. And so we wanted to surface some of these just to show, you know, there's some really cool little nooks and places. And, you know, even a lot of Microsoft employees might not know about the anechoic chamber and some of the different stuff that we do. So it was kind of cool. We went around and shot some of these. And, you know, we kind of keep a list of, you know, oh, that's kind of cool. We should show that sometime. And so if there's anything that you've heard of that you want us to go check out, can't go show you Ballmer's office, but
So these buildings here, which people don't probably realize, this is the original block. This is why you got it on the logo, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
This is actually 1, 2, 3, and 4. So this is 4's here, and Bill Gates was right there, top floor.
Yeah, and I remember when I went to interview Bill Hill, he was in one of those buildings there, and there's a nice little lake in between them, and or a little pond with, you know, fish and everything.
Is History of Microsoft still on?
I hope so, yeah.
So there's another series that, if you're interested in the old-time stuff, which I am, every single year there is a video about every single year from birth.
Yeah, it was a very cool series by Tina.
Tina, yeah.
So, who did that. Yeah, it was very cool.
One per year, there's a lot. So
yeah, so you can see more about the campus, you can learn more about Microsoft, and nice pick of the week.
Definitely.
Thanks for the shout-out.
Well, thanks for the video.
Awesome. So that's show this week. If you want to write us, you can send an email to defragshow@microsoft.com or leave a message in the comments. We like the email so we can go back and forth on
Definitely.
Problem if we have to. And we'll see you next week.
Have a good week.